when you have these desk adjusters that work in these call centers in small town, you know, Midwest, they see estimates from all over the country. So they'll see a job. They're like, oh, well, you know, I just paid the same job. It cost 10 grand down in Louisiana. But we're like, well, now we're in suburban San Diego or Los Angeles or something like that. And I'm like, hey, $50 an hour isn't a viable price to hire anyone here and any tradesman kind of thing. So it's, there's a lot of just lack of knowledge and experience in the industry.
Welcome to the Collecting Keys Podcast,
the show where you'll learn how to use real estate to create massive income, not just passive income. Real estate doesn't have to be a get-rich-slow game. Listen to the country's top real estate operators, and you'll have all the tools you need to replace your W-2 income and go beyond in under 12 months. Ready to take things to the next level? Let's jump in with our hosts, Mike DeHaan and Dan Austin, for today's episode of the Collecting Keys Podcast.
What is going on, guys? Welcome to today's episode of the Collecting Keys Real Estate Investing Podcast. Today we have David Melzer, who is a personal friend and an insurance adjuster out of Southern California. He lives in San Diego specifically. And we have a great deep dive into what you're supposed to do when you have a rental property or your own house that has some sort of insurance claim issue and you're looking at it and you're going, I feel like I'm not getting enough money for the situation. Guys like David, they can come and help you solve that and help you get significantly more money, right? By, you know, working with the insurance company and helping adjust the claims that, you know, you're battling back and forth with the insurance company about. So this is a really, really awesome episode. We go into everything you need to know about working with an adjuster. He talks about some tips and tricks for how to get the most out of the conversation, when exactly you should look to hire an adjuster and how you vet adjusters to make sure that you're getting a good one. And really, you know, if you're a real estate investor, this is a must listen. Because, you know, it's not if you eventually have an insurance problem, it's when. Because if you own real estate, stuff does happen. We got weather changing all around the world. We got weird stuff that goes on. You have, you know, wiring that wears out. You have plumbing that wears out. Eventually, you're going to have problems and insurance companies are not fun to deal with. But that's why guys like David exist. So grab your notebook. This is a really, really awesome episode and will be super educational for you. Also, the great news is David works in a bunch of the Western states and also Tennessee and Kentucky. So if you like what you're hearing and you want to reach out to him, definitely do so at the links that he drops at the end, and he can help you figure out any of your insurance rules to deal with. So we appreciate you all listening. Please go and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcast and enjoy this really, really educational show with David Melzer. All right. We are here today with David Melzer from San Diego, and I am super excited to have you on the show today, David, because I met you in Lake Oconee at the GoBundance conference, and you have a business that I think is so applicable to real estate investors. And you are a, I guess, tell me if I explain this wrong, but you are a insurance claims adjuster, like a consultant. We can kind of go into it, but either way, your property is called Property Claims Consultant, and you help people like us or other real estate investors not get completely screwed over by insurance companies when things go awry. So super excited to have you on the show, man. So I guess maybe give us a little background about you and what exactly you do with your business.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mike. I'm excited to be here. The proper term would be public insurance adjusters. Sometimes it changes a little bit state by state, but that's kind of what we're mostly known as, is public adjusters. And so what I always kind of tell people is that envision, you know, you're going through the worst of all scenarios when it comes to your insurance claim, your home burned down. Let's just say it's your single family, your primary residence, and you have nothing. I mean, you leave the house with the, you know, it's in the middle of the night, you leave your house with what, sleep attire and you know, maybe your cell phone or things like that. And now you've got to try and piece together this home on your own against like the biggest bureaucracy in the world, pretty much, these multi-trillion dollar insurance companies. And so the insurance companies always will come out and they always give you a lowball estimate. I mean, I know, I think we had talked briefly where you even said the same thing, where you guys have been lowballing, and it happens all the time. Our main goal and focus is really just tackling the financial aspect of the claims and getting people the highest dollar that they can get out of these insurance claims and maintaining like absolutely like an ethical boundary when it comes to that. Everything that we do is just playing the cards that the insurance company does right back at them. So like the insurance company has teams and teams of adjusters that are trained endlessly to be able to adjust the claim that brings the outcome that they're looking for. I always say this kind of to our clients, to say, well, why don't you have a team helping you adjust the claim on your end as well? So we're just advocates in the court of the homeowner. And that can be the homeowner, the investor. We do everything from businesses to warehouses to manufacturing facilities to manufactured homes to residential homes to apartment complexes, kind of the whole spectrum. As long as there's, when there's like first party property damages, and that's how we really come in. And then most public adjusters work on a contingency fee. Some will kind of do some hourly consulting work, but most of the time it's a contingency fee. So we're very inclined and motivated to get you guys like the most you can for your buck, because that's how, like, we have a direct linear correlation of how much we get paid. And selfishly, we want to make a buck as well. So,
I got so many questions on this one, but like, let's start with, so the idea of like what that insurance company's team looks like. And, you know, like Mike and I have gone through these, and what I see, and so I'll just share this, and then I would love to get your insights on like the insider baseball stuff on this, because I think you worked for insurance companies prior, right?
Yeah. I was with them for about 10 years.
Okay, perfect. So yes. Yeah, so like you file a claim, you've got your, you know, we have an insurance agent who just shops for us. So we call her and say, hey, we got this claim. And then they obviously refers to the insurance company that's on that property. We go through it, and then they send out an adjuster that works for that company. They come out, look at it like, yeah, man, this is damaged. And then they come and give an estimate of what it's going to cost to fix. And then basically, you can go and get a contractor to do the work for that price. Hopefully, that's the price that the contractor can do it for. I would have thought it would be the other way around, like go get your contractor, get quotes, and then tell us, but it's not. Can you kind of give us like the rundown on how that whole business works? Because it seems terrible.
It's really just a whole succession of checks and balances on the insurance carrier side that really sets the consumer up for failure.
Yeah.
And let me kind of focus on that question first, and like how the adjusters work. And so, I mean, they're trained to work off of their specific estimating platform. And there is so much criticism and so many eyes on an estimate. Or so like, let's say, for instance, they come out to your house, you had a flood in your kitchen or something. The adjuster comes out and writes, you know, X, Y, and Z for the cabinet, some countertops, some drywall or whatever. That might get looked at 4, 5, 6 times by their superior, a re-inspector, a quality assurance type person, quality management type person. They have, you know, different names within each insurance company. And so each person is going to say, oh, that line item isn't justified. Let's pull that one out. Oh, that one's not justified. So this adjuster that comes out there might start with a $20,000 estimate, but by the time it goes through the ringer with this internal review team, it might get cut down in half. So even if the adjuster missed some stuff, now it gets cut down 2 more or 3 more times. And so you're left with this work product or your estimate from them that's just so minimal that you just can't, you can't actually get the job done.
Yeah.
And then you'd mentioned, like, why doesn't it go the other way where, hey, I've got 3 contractors. They say it's going to be X, Y, and Z dollars. Why can't you just pay the mean of these estimates kind of things? And that was kind of the long ago, like late 90s, early 90s, kind of perspective on the insurance companies, is that they would do that exactly. Is that before the invent of, you know, internet and the ability to handle things remotely, everybody would just go to their respective contractor, or in the cases of auto body claims, they'd go to like a body shop and get 3 estimates. The insurance company would kind of just take the mean of the estimates and pay that. But since then, now they're doing things virtually, they're sending out adjusters and things like that, trying to minimize that dollar amount and be competitive in the industry. And so they very seldomly will actually just take a contractor's estimate and pay it. It's always going to go through this gambit of reviews internal.
So that's funny, or not funny, it's interesting, because you brought up auto claims, and I feel like that system is pretty dialed in, because I go to like an auto body shop and they're like, yeah, our cost is going to be exactly what the insurance company is going to pay. So like, they figure that out, you know. I don't know if the work is quality or whatever, but generally when I get my car bashed in, I go there. My insurance company says, take it to one of these 3 body shops. They fix it. They all figure it out. So they got like these like preferred people or whatever. But it definitely seems the opposite with like houses and contractors. Like, they definitely don't listen to what another contractor, to your point. And I wonder if there's a reason why that is, or maybe there's just so much variability compared to cars.
It's the variability. I mean, okay. You look at, so, and I worked in auto claims as well years and years ago. So I've seen the difference of it. And like when you take a Honda Civic, I mean, there is a book that'll show you the cost of every single part, the labor that's associated with installing this headlamp or this hood or this. So it's like, it's a very linear equation. When you get into a home, it's not the same, because then it's like, okay, you've got continuous flooring. Does that flooring go into other bedrooms? Then when you, does that flooring go under cabinets? Like there's so many other elements and variables. Then also like how much stuff is in the way? Like, do we need to pack the whole house out to do the repairs? You know, are we painting just these walls? Are we painting those walls? So it's, the big difference is that variability component, and that's what plays into it a lot. The auto world, the reason why it's actually gotten pretty successful is they've automized a lot. A lot of it does go through an AI-like system. When I was at Farmers, that was 2012, 2013, before I left there, they brought in, this is when AI was very, very new, and they brought in kind of like an entry-level type AI system, and it would just scrub estimates. So literally, it would just take an estimate and just knock 20% off the top and approve it, because it was cheaper for the insurance companies to do that than employ, you know, people, staff, sending them out to inspections, drive time, a workers' comp, and all that.
Fascinating. So, okay, let me, if you don't mind, Mike, let me indulge myself here and let me share an example of an insurance claim we dealt with. And I would love to get your opinion, David, on like how you would have served us in this situation. So we had, this was, gosh, a year and a half, 2 years ago now, Mike?
Yeah, last like spring.
We had an insurance claim.
A while ago.
Yeah, so it was an Airbnb property that we had just done a top to bottom renovation in, main floor and basement. The one thing we foolishly didn't replace was the oil furnace. So it still had an oil tank, and it was like a concrete utility room oil tank in there with like a little teeny copper wire or a copper tube that went from the oil tank to the furnace. So the furnace itself was fine, but that copper tube failed and it flooded with hundreds of gallons of oil into this basement. It was like new carpet, new LVP, brand new shower, brand new, I mean, everything was brand new in this, including furniture.
Finished basement.
Finished basement.
Yep. Yeah, go back.
And so essentially we called our insurance agent, she called the insurance company, got it all set up. And this lady with the company came out and she's like, okay, yeah, this is really bad. I'm going to dispatch a company, a remediation company. And I was like, okay. And so they dispatched the remediation company and then had to get like a hygienist in there to look at what it was. Then they got, I guess, the quote from somebody to build up like what it would take to replace this. And then this remediation company that they had sent out basically just didn't hold up their end of the bargain and did a bunch of the work, got a bunch of the oil soaked up, but didn't finish the job. And then they were arguing with the insurance company about replacing the floor, what are they called? The sill plates of the walls that soaked up oil. And the insurance company said, you don't need to do that. They said, you do. And essentially they end up walking off the job. I'm going to make this long story short. And then we had to bring in our contractor and finish it all. And this was like a 6 month process,
least.
Mike, maybe 8 months. And the whole time we're obviously missing rent on this thing. And of course we didn't have the Airbnb, whatever they call that, rider on the policy.
Oh, no, okay.
Yeah. So finally it all gets wrapped up. They had to give us three different adjusters from the same company because they kept having such problems with the situation. And I know that they must've messed up because at the end, they were willing to cut us a check for the lost revenue of like $15,000 from the Airbnb, which they 100% and I 100% in email agreed we were not owed because we did not pay for that policy. So I know they messed up at some level, but yeah, it was like this big battle and they were essentially just fighting everything as far as the cost to do anything. And so we ended up bringing our contractor in and just finishing it, and didn't matter what they paid us, we had to get it done. And so yeah, it took 6-8 months.
Yeah, and that's something that I hear so frequently is that, so when we had touched earlier where you said you take it to an auto body shop, it's their preferred vendor when you have a car accident, and they just kind of settle it out on the back end. That's how it's kind of supposed to work in a perfect world on the property with their specific vendors.
Okay.
But it's not. When you have things like oil like that, it's just not a standard water loss. So they were probably treating that like you just had a toilet overflow or something like that. It's water. Let's just clean up the water. But when it's oil and you're affecting sill plates and things like that, that can actually, you're right, that can cause a substantial amount of damages. And then I would imagine that oil's flammable or combustible at some ability or some component too. So it's like you don't need, you have that in the walls, seal up the walls, and now you have an electrical short, you might cause like an actual explosion type thing. So I guess I'll kind of speak high level, like how we would come in and get involved. Yeah. And kind of fight for something like that. And just, I speak to what the insurance companies have done. And so typically this is like that. Yeah, we would enlist the services of a hygienist, an industrial hygienist right out of the gate, because it takes the ambiguity and out of the discussion with the insurance company. Because the insurance company, it's, you've got someone behind a desk working the job, handling it virtually. And they're like, oh, it's just oil, you know, put some rags down, clean it up and walk away. And it's like, no, that's not how you do it. So these industrial hygienists, that would be the right approach. They come out in, they're completely another third party company that takes us out of the equation, takes the insurance company out of the equation and put together, they'll usually put together a scope of work. And that helps us kind of begin the argument. But the public adjusters are really good and known for being very detailed document. So like the insurance company, for them to pay X, they need to see Y, or they need to see some documentation for that. And so what we do is, what we would do is come in something like that. We would take readings that will probably show moisture. It's elevated moisture of actually the oil and stuff, and the oil and whatever compounds are in there. We have the industrial hygienist, and then we even put together an estimate. So like, we put together this whole package, photo documentation, industrial hygienists, an estimate itself, and provide them with like everything to check their boxes. Because in a perfect world, we want to settle the claim just as fast as they want to settle it, because we want you guys to be happy. We want to move on and help other clients. And, you know, the insurance company doesn't want to deal with us because we're not going away. So the big thing that we would do is really just come in and try and document and get an estimate, the proper estimate to them as soon as possible, rather than kind of saying, oh, let's just get this contractor going and have them kind of, oh, they'll work with the insurance company on the back end, because you see how that kind of caused some issues in the beginning. So it's something we often see where there's just disputes between these third-party vendors that they send out that they say are part of their vendor program. Was that desk adjuster even in the same state, or was that adjuster you were dealing with at a call center in, you know, the Midwest?
No, she was the one. She was actually located in our hometown where the property was. And then the other one, after they kicked her off, was in like somewhere in the Midwest. And then the third one was some other guy from this local area. And he actually is the one that was like, okay, I'm going to get this shit resolved for you and all that sort of stuff. And I think he kind of had to clean up a little bit of a mess.
Yeah. I mean, what also kind of speaks to is that when you have these desk adjusters that work in these call centers in small town, you know, Midwest, they see estimates from all over the country. So they'll see a job. They're like, oh, well, you know, I just paid the same job. It cost 10 grand down in Louisiana. Yeah. But we're like, well, now we're in, you know, suburban San Diego or Los Angeles or something like that. And I'm like, hey, $50 an hour isn't a viable price to hire anyone here and any tradesman kind of thing. So it's, there's a lot of just lack of knowledge and experience in the industry. A lot of these desk adjusters that you're working with are also fresh out of college. I mean, that's how I got the job and got into the industry originally, is I came in right out of college with very little experience. They put you through a training program that fits their curriculum and like their narrative and their the way that they want to drive claims. And then you go out and kind of you're fairly autonomous for at least a lot of the field inspections and things like that. And that's where stuff gets missed.
So your role when people come to hire you is essentially to give a foolproof, like you can't deny that this is what needs to be fixed. And here is the cost based on this data of what that will cost. That's kind of the hope, right?
And we provide them with everything they need. I mean, there could be, hey, when we removed these baseboards, it actually peeled up the paint. So now we've got to paint the walls. We take a close-up photo of that and label it and say, hey, look, now you need to paint the walls. Then they're like, okay, cool. That documents our file. And now when I include it, you know, and my file gets reviewed by some quality assurance person or a manager, they're going to see, oh, that's what happened. There's direct physical damages. Let's pay it and move on kind of thing. So
makes sense.
So it's really like a detail-oriented documentation and plan of approach for the entirety of the claim itself, so that they've got everything in front of them. I mean, like we do a lot of the jobs for these insurance adjusters because we just want to move these claims along, where they'll be fighting, hey, we didn't see damage in this room. Okay, cool. Here, we've already got photos showing moisture readings or oil in the room if we're talking about your instance. So they're really just trying to take the reins on it and drive that claim to the narrative that we know is going to have the best financial outcome for our clients.
Right. Okay. Fascinating.
Do you ever have situations where, I don't know, I would say you have a client who feels like the insurance adjuster is too low. You come in and you do your thing and you find that it's actually the other way around, that the insurance is being too generous. at that point, do you have like a fiduciary responsibility on either side, or do you kind of just like keep your mouth shut?
It happens. I mean, I've been called out, and what I see that happens more often than not is there's usually like cultural differences where you've got maybe a first generation American where the way that things work in their culture is everything is negotiation. So no matter what, you know, if the insurance company came out with 10 grand, even if it was 10 grand, they still feel that there's some sort of level of negotiation. And yeah, so we do see it. And there's been a lot of times where we come out and say, hey, look, like, we don't think there's anything more on the table. You know, you were taken care of. We can't help you. You know, we wish you the best of luck and move on. And so it does happen because we do have a fiduciary responsibility to our clients. And when that happens, it's really the best situation for the clients. I mean, we really don't, in a perfect world, our role really wouldn't exist, but it does.
Yeah, but it's needed.
How do you get paid in all these? Like, what does that relationship look like? Are you paid basically by the person that hires you directly? Is there like something that's worked into like the size of the job? Do you get paid the same if it's like a water leak in a kitchen versus a house fire? You know, what does all that look like?
Each state is a little bit differently, but most states you have to work on a contingency basis. So like in California, it's a fairly limitless, they call it like a limitless or non-cap fee agreements, but we can't exceed 49%. And that's kind of pretty standard. Like we can't charge more of a fee than what the client gets. But so most of the times we come on a contingency basis. It depends on what type of claim we get involved in and at what stage of the claim. So sometimes people call us and say, hey, look, we've been driving this claim for 9 months. There's another 50 grand on the table, we think. And we look at it, we're like, okay, that's going to be, we have to rehash the entire claim. We've got to start from scratch and now work through where they have already done and then try and get this additional supplemental 50, so to speak. Instances like that will be on a contingency fee, usually on a higher contingency fee, like 30%, sometimes even higher. So that would mean that we would charge 30% for above and beyond where they've already gotten. So if they struck out at 50 grand, we think there's another 50 grand, then we would be on a contingency fee for that additional 50 that we get them. When you alluded to or you had mentioned about like big house fires and things like that, if we get involved in those claims in the early onset, so let's say, for instance, like we signed up an apartment, a client two days ago, they had an apartment fire. So it's two apartments with an attached single family home. Kind of a weird property, cool property, but we signed them up before the insurance company even got involved because it was a direct referral from a friend. And something like that, we're on 10% from dollar one. And so we build in 10% there, or we charge them 10%. They end up paying us. The money doesn't really come directly from the insurance company. It does come from our clients, but in instances like that, where we know we're going to get them 2, maybe 3, maybe even 4x the dollar that they would get, they're like, no one ever shies away from saying, oh yeah, hey, you're really owed that. So it's like, they see it because the insurance company's first undisputed estimate might be 100 grand and we land at 400 and they realize, oh, if I'm on a 10%, yeah, this person definitely deserved that $40,000 that they get.
Okay.
So the answer question, big, like kind of high level, contingency fee, it does come from the clients. And that's why typically public adjusters are more suited for the larger claims because there's just a lot more items to build in. Like for instance, some people will, you know, if it's really a financial crunch, you know, and we get them a lot more money, they'll say, okay, hey, we're going to take that money and put it towards the kitchen cabinets and we'll save money on the flooring so we can pay their fee or something like that. Or I'm going to hire a contractor to do the inside damages, but I've got a roofer that can do the roof. So I'll subcontract out the roof, and that's where I'll kind of gain back the money or the fee for the public adjuster. Like, there's a lot of things, and then they're not unethical. It's just you kind of have to do work around it, but we still get them so much more than the insurance company actually pays.
Yeah.
That, I mean, out of the 400 clients that we've helped over the last few years, I've had one actually walk away from us and stiff us. Every single other one has been more than happy to pay our fee. I mean, there's not, they just really have any disputes.
I would have definitely paid your fee.
Yeah, if we totally.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They see the first estimate because we tell them, we're like, hey, look, we're getting out there. And we're like, hey, look, they're going to pay you 100 grand. But we think we're probably going to land at 300 or 400 in this instance. And they're like, sure, whatever, you know, because it's super early on. And then when they see the first check, they're like, oh shit, you guys are right. And then we, you know, we get into it and then here's another $100,000, another $100,000. They're like, okay, hey, you're good. Yeah. Keep doing your thing.
So typically, is it best for people to reach out to you or like someone like you, like early in the transaction, like basically in the process, like right when it happens or until they're getting, until they're getting screwed by the insurance company?
Honestly, the best bet for all parties involved is early on, because a few different components. One, the insurance companies are becoming more and more denial basis, I guess, kind of things. We're seeing it a lot in California, where a lot of the insurance companies are denying claims a lot sooner and a lot quicker. And when a claim gets denied, it's very difficult to overturn it. And most public adjusters, a lot of public adjusters may not even take the claim on.
Yeah.
So sometimes people give up information that isn't even related to the claim that leads in a denial.
Uh-huh.
So for instance, roof claims. It's a common thing that we see across the country. We don't see them a lot here in San Diego, but we see them a lot in the rest of the country. Different insurance policies have different limitations when it comes to leaking roofs. And sometimes people will say, oh, yeah, I had a leak to my roof 10 years ago, but they never said that they actually did get that roof repaired. Now, come present day, they had another leak to their roof. The insurance company says, oh, well, it leaked 10 years ago. You never repaired it. Denied. Boom. And just close the file out and walk away and refuse to really hear new information that may actually be the smoking gun to overturn the claim. So I don't want to go on a crazy tangent, but things like that happen because when the insurance companies get on the phone with the homeowners, for some reason, homeowners just want to just talk and tell. And the insurance companies will ask questions that sometimes lead in a denial that really aren't legitimate true denials of coverage. And there are some instances where, hey, look, this policy does not cover that. There's nothing we can do about it. It's just the policy that you signed up does not cover X, Y, and Z. And that is what it is. But
yeah, that is interesting. I mean, we see that a lot, just like on the real estate transaction side too, right? Whether it's, you know, sellers sharing a lot of information with us when we're doing off-market stuff. Can't tell you how many times we've been on the phone with sellers and they'll drop like a little clip about their divorce or like, you know, yeah, Timmy stole some money from me or whatever. And we're like, oh, really? You know, and now we have a cued in motivation.
So you're motivated.
Right. Yeah. But then also too, even on the retail real estate side, I think it's just because naturally as humans, we want to converse with other people, you know, especially when they're on the phone or you're talking about a situation. You have people shoot themselves in the foot by mentioning things to lenders, like about, oh yeah, how I'm getting ready to start a new job. It's like, you're not supposed to freaking do that when you're buying a house, right? And now the lenders are like nervous about that or people mentioning things like that, the title companies. And it's interesting. I think it's just a very important reminder for everyone who goes through this when you're talking to that insurance company, like don't overshare things at all. Like let them kind of ask the questions and just like give the most plain answers that you can and let them make their own decisions, right?
I always say it's like you're getting arrested. You kind of have the right to remain silent.
Right. Yeah.
For sure. If they ask the questions, just answer them very directly. Like, are you employed? Yes. You know, what happened? I had a leak to the roof. Like, don't go on to, oh, my cat was up there and might have kicked something. You know, you're right. It's just people give up a little bit too much information and it can be misinterpreted.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, you know, are there drugs in your trunk? I don't know.
And they're not mine.
Right? Just plead ignorance. Then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
If someone's looking to work like with an insurance adjuster, what are the kind of questions that like, the person that's looking to hire you should ask, or like what designates a good insurance adjuster versus a bad one?
I would think the big things where we found success is just the experience and the way that they process claims. Our claims are the entire process of how we handle a claim and process it is driven by, in California, the California regulations and insurance code. So we create all of our arguments and the demands that we put forth are on a basis of those regulations and insurance code. Because at the end of the day, if it doesn't work out with us, which it doesn't often, but every once in a while it will, we can hand it over to an attorney. And the attorney's like, hey, you already made these legal arguments, so to speak, and they can run with it. So I think that the big thing would be is experience in the industry. I think that public adjusters do very well when they have prior experience working for the insurance company. And that's how a lot of my team is. A lot of my team came from some component or some avenue in the insurance industry. I also see a benefit of them looking for referrals, just like anything else. Like when you get a referral from, like, see, my family friend worked with them, or looking at like past reviews on Google, Yelp, social media, Facebook, things like that. I think that's another place to rule out and kind of separate from some of the bad eggs in our industry. Unfortunately, there are, just like any other industry, there are some bad apples in our world, and it can get tied up with things. But I often see that when people look for like Yelp reviews, Google reviews, those tend to weed those guys out of the mix because they help a few clients and people are very vocal about it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So I have so many questions, but I'm going to bring up, for the interest of time, because I know we're going to run short here, insurance prices. Like, as real estate investors, we're all seeing like insurance prices like drastically jump. And I know this isn't necessarily your business, but just because you're in the industry, I'm curious, because we're seeing obviously in markets like Florida, markets like Texas, like specifically Houston, like there's insurers leaving altogether. Mm-hmm. We've had that in Washington State, some insurers leaving. I think some of that has to do with legal policy, but like what is going on in the industry? Because it's cutting into everybody's margins right now, seeing in prices increase 10 to 20%.
Yeah. The high level answer is the reinsurance component. It's so a lot of these large storm, hurricanes, natural disasters, fires in California, hurricanes in the Gulf Coast area, those are causing such substantial and huge impacts on the environment there that these insurance companies can't get reinsurance. And so reinsurance is, you know, let's just say Farmers Insurance, like a big name insurance company that everybody knows. They have insurance to cover $1 billion worth of damages if a big fire happened in Southern California, but they have insurance for their insurance. So if there is a huge, huge event, someone has to come in on the back end and say, hey, if it goes beyond $1 billion, we'll step in for you. And so what's happening is that with the increased natural disasters and cost of these natural disasters, those reinsurance companies aren't even writing policies to cover the larger insurance. So it's like a trickle-down type effect. There's also been some regulatory and legislative stuff, at least in some of the West Coast states that have come down to where, specifically in California, they have stopped allowing the insurance companies to take rates. So that means like adjust their rate on premiums. And so that kind of prohibits them from just being the free market and saying, okay, everybody's just going to be as efficient as they can and try and provide a competitive product. And when there are regulatory type agencies that are limiting their ability to operate at their fullest extent as the free market would allow, that's where you kind of run into those issues as well. And that's what we're seeing. So an answer to it, I don't know. I think it's a part legislative and part environmental impact.
I think you nailed it. So I did not know that there are insurance companies for insurance companies. And that would make sense because I do think that some of these natural disasters that cause so much damage is just driving the cost for everybody in the country. Because the same insurance company in Florida is, say, Farmers, is up here in Washington. That company still has its same profit margin regardless of where the storm's at. And so it affects everybody. And then we know here in Washington, they have similar rules where they can no longer use like credit or income to insure people. Like it has to all be across the line. And we've seen insurers leave the state because of that and just the legislative effects of that. So it's, I think you nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. It's a complex business, right? And there's so many different variables.
I would say for the real estate world, what I say is shop it yearly.
Mm-hmm.
Get a broker or get a few brokers. And I work with a bunch and shop. I mean, if you've got over 3 or 4 properties, I think you are going to see a huge benefit of shopping those properties once a year.
Yeah.
Sounds
too. Totally. Awesome. Well, really good stuff, David. I really appreciate you coming and sharing all that. All right. So we are coming up on time here. So we're going to dive into our end of show questions. So I know you're not a professional real estate investor, but you still have a little bit of real estate investing experience. And I'm super excited for your crazy story because we talked about it in Georgia and it's one of the wildest stories I've ever heard. Our number one question, which is always the crowd favorite, what is your craziest real estate investing story?
Yeah, I know. I've told the story a bunch. So before I started my company, I owned a multifamily here in San Diego. And it's technically 2 small houses on a lot. But so I have to kind of envision and play out the layout of the property to understand what's going on. So you've got the city street up here, and then the houses are down here. So there was probably about a 20-foot gap between the city street here and the property down here. If you know anything about plumbing, drainage in the plumbing world works on a gravitational level. So there's no pumps typically in a normal house. Like, so when you flush the toilet, it goes into a drain. That drain is just sloped. And so it drains into the city main. So most instances, houses sit slightly above the city street so that it could just drain into the city meat. Well, this property, when I kind of drew it out, is that the city street was up here, the houses were down here. So they all drained into a well in the front of the property. And that well then had a pump. And in that well, there was a pump. The pump would pump into the city street. So flush a toilet, goes into a well about 50 feet in front of the property. And at the bottom of the well, about 15, 20 feet, there's a pump. It pumps it up to the city street. So I bought this property and turned over to the both of the units, both of the homes. And I was pretty much, it was pretty much all in for it. I didn't really have much left over for, you know, closing costs, buying it, and then the amount of work that it needed. I was about 3 or 4 months into it, having some serious issues with this pump, and they call it a sewage ejection pump and system. And so I found myself, and I wish I would have pulled up the photo, but I am sitting at the top of the well, realizing that I have to go down in this well. I am in a full Tyvek suit, like goggles, respirator, Tyvek suit, gloves, booties, and I've got an extension cord wrapped around my body. The extension cord is connected to the back of my 72-year-old mother's Hummer, because when you go down into these wells, it's shit water, and methane is heavier than oxygen. So when you get down to the bottom, there's technically no oxygen. So my mom is sitting up there with a big fan, a big box fan, trying to circulate water. I've got a extension cord because I didn't have any other rope. So if I were to pass out, it was connected to her car, she could just rip me out. And I climbed down this well, and I am about waist deep and shoulder deep in water, blindly trying to disconnect this pump so that I can bring it up to the surface, reconfigure it. I had to fix one of the there's a spinning motor on it, and then go back down there. So keep in mind, this well is about 3 feet in diameter. So I'm a pretty large human. So you're bent over, and your head is up, and you can't even see it. You're just working blindly. And so, I mean, I got it. I had to disconnect it from the city main. And when I disconnect the city main, it's like spewing out poop water. And then I had to disconnect it from the bottom. And so then, I mean, I got it, disconnected that. I had a small ladder in there that I climbed up. I was up the top. I fixed it. But then I had to go back down and reconnect it back up. And as soon as I reconnected back up, it wasn't connected fully at the top mount. So it started spitting water against the wall and splashing everywhere. But I mean, got it fixed.
Oh my God.
And didn't pass out and got out of the well. And, you know, that was one of the big turning points of me realizing that I'm not going to self-manage real estate. And I do need to hire out and know my own value and worth.
Bro. There's so many things in this story that I am blown away. A, that you're alive. Like, that's like a serious thing. Like, enclosed space training. Like, guys go down there with like oxygen masks, not Tyvek suits and respirators.
Yeah.
An extension cord that is not rated for a guy your size.
Oh, that's the first thing I said too.
And your mom's 72 and she has a Hummer. Like, what? That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you're like an old school Hummer H3. And it was, and I mean, the only rope we had, and like, it was leaking out into one of the homes. So like, I had to get it done right then and there. And the only thing I had was an extension cord. And I'm like, it's wire. It's got to have a pull strength of, you know, 300 pounds. I weigh 220 plus everything else. Like, it's got to cover at least 200 plus pounds. So
yeah. And Dave's not a small dude, Dan. David's like as big as I am.
Oh, I met him. I know how big he is. Yeah. He's a big dude. He's bigger. He's probably stronger.
Oh,
than
definitely.
Me.
Everyone's stronger than me at this point. I'm old and washed up. But no, that's so freaking wild. Like, yeah, I'm glad that you lived another day.
That's amazing.
So how old were you when you were doing this?
That was like 2017. So it's 6 years ago. So like 28, 29.
You were old enough to know better. Awesome.
Yeah. I didn't realize that I was on the way down to do this, knowing that I would probably have to climb down it. And my dad calls me and he's like, hey, dumbass, methane is heavier than oxygen. You won't have anything. And it's not like you will be like, oh, I'm running short of air. He's like, no, you would just pass out. He went into some chemistry behind it. But he's like, you would just pass out and you wouldn't even know about it. And so I was like, oh, I'll just run a fan. And so I just had a fan circulating oxygen. I was like, that'll do. And then I even went to the point where the first time I climbed down, I was like, I'm just going to hold my breath. But it took me a lot longer. So I would like kind of go up and down a few times. And yeah, it was,
dude.
You're like an open water diver, but in shit water in a methane tube.
Shit water in a methane tube.
That's crazy.
And I mean, I was getting like, there's little floaters and everything. Like, it was in the thick of it.
That's so bad.
Anyway, so then when you got it fixed, did you have to go back down there to plug it back in again?
I had to fix it because the sewage ejection pumps have, it's like a sump pump, mm-hmm. but it has a little grinder. So it grinds up the solids before it ejects it out.
Yeah.
And that little grinder got clogged up with some stuff on it.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I had to fix that and then run it back down.
Then you had to go tell your tenants to stop eating so much fiber because they're blocking up your sump pump.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's just clogging up the rotor on the ejection pump.
Dude,
crazy.
I'm just having nightmares right now. What was floating in there?
Wild. That's awesome. Well, I appreciate you sharing that, David. That's a good story. That's a great podcast story. And I bet too, after a couple of drinks, you become the guy with like the best story everyone's ever heard. Because that's crazy.
That's a good story.
It's funny because when I that's how I kind of led the GoBundance call here. I wonder, can I share a screen with you guys? I think I've got the photo.
Yeah, you should be able to share screen at the bottom if you want to do that.
I know you guys are running out of time.
Oh, you're good. You can also send it to us and we'll work it into the YouTube video too. So if you guys want to see the video, what I was going on, you go check out YouTube. All right. Second question. We usually do, what is the number one piece of advice you would give to a small investor looking to take their business to the next level? But instead, maybe let's change this and go, what's the number one piece of advice you would give to a real estate investor that is dealing with an insurance issue and they're looking to hire someone like you? Like, what's kind of like the one or two things that they should absolutely know?
I mean, if you're going through an insurance claim that's anything over $25,000, it's to seek out help from a public adjuster. Do your due diligence on them. I mean, just as you would with a real estate agent or whatever, buying a property, you know, do your due diligence on it. But there's really never been an instance where we've gotten involved where we haven't, just from a cost-benefit analysis, provided a huge benefit from our... It takes the emotional stress off of our clients. You know, sometimes our clients, you know, the husband and wife are in crazy disagreements. You know, the wife is super stressed out about the property. The husband's trying to manage this insurance claim and it just creates a big feud in the family and we're able to alleviate that. So like, it's not only just the financial components of it, it's the emotional stress it puts on people. And I really say that now seeing, and so that property too that I showed you, I had an insurance claim there as well. And that insurance claim, they tried to pay me $8,500.
Wow.
And we ended up at $180 on the settlement on that. So like,
wow,
there's a benefit there. So like, if that was me and I came on at 20%, like, so you pay me $40,000 to get you an additional $140,000, like that's worth it. I would put money down on that investment all day, any day, every day. So my biggest thing is just don't think that the insurance companies are on your side. You know, they're not always maliciously there to financially impact you, but they just have a different perspective and financial outcome and goal than what you're looking for. And finding help in the public adjuster sector is always going to be there.
Awesome. That's great advice. Cool. All right, David, last question. Where can people find you, follow you, and reach out to you if you'd like them to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. Best thing would probably be just on our Instagram. Our Instagram account is just at propertyclaimsconsultant.com. And we're there. We're pretty active on Instagram, Facebook, Yelp, and Google. And we're here in pretty much every West Coast state, pretty much all states west of the Rockies, we're licensed and operate.
All the states that really matter, let's be honest. West Coast, the best coast, and all of our Southeast listeners, which is most of them, just stop listening. Awesome, David. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, I mean, actually, we are in Kentucky and Tennessee as well.
Yeah, that's good to know. We have a lot of people in Tennessee.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank
actually,
you guys.
Surprisingly. But there's like certain states over there, we get a ton of listenership. We get none from Georgia, a ton from Florida, and a ton from Tennessee that listen to us on a regular basis. So it's good to know. Awesome. Well, David, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. We really, really appreciate your time. And you guys, I hope that you learned a lot from this episode. If you are a real estate investor and you own any sort of properties, there's a ton that you can get out of this. And you should definitely reach out to David if you live in any of the West Coast states or Tennessee or Kentucky, because he can potentially help you out if you have any insurance woes. And besides that, if you don't live in one of those states, then find who the good person is in your market, because it could save you an insane amount of money here. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to y'all next week. See y'all.
Thanks for listening to Collecting Keys.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes and send us a screenshot to mike@collectingkeys.com for your chance to receive a free Collecting Keys t-shirt.